Case 20-2117, Oak Brook Land Holdings LLC et al. Versus Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Foster for the appellants.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is David Foster for Appellant Oak Brook Land Holdings through its tax matters partner, Dwayne Horton. We're here today because the flaws in Treasury's administrative process have cast into doubt hundreds, if not thousands, of deductions promised by Congress to taxpayers who gave up valuable property rights on millions of acres of land to further the congressional goal of conserving the environment for future generations. When it came time to issue regulations to implement Congress's statute, Treasury expressly declared itself exempt from the APA. In Treasury's own words, quoting from the upper right of JA 645, the notice and comment procedures requirements of 5 USC 553 did not apply to its regulatory project. And with respect to its proceeds regulation, Treasury did not follow those requirements. Treasury received 13 comments on the proposed regulation, which identified problems, raised issues with Treasury's policy choices, and proposed alternatives for Treasury to consider. And what was Treasury's response? In the words of Tax Court Judge Holmes, the chirping of crickets. And that's why we're here. It's undisputed that Oak Brook and the SRLC were trying to comply with the law. And had Treasury responded to these comments with an explanation, there wouldn't have been widespread adoption, including by other government agencies, including the EPA, of deed language that the IRS now says violates the regulation.
Are there particular comments? I understand there were either 13 or 14 comments on the topic generally. Were there particular ones of those that you would say to us should have alerted the Treasury to an alternative proposal other than no provision at all?
Yes, there were three primary comments. The one that is the most with the alternatives would be the one from the Trust for Public Land on JA 795, and they collated comments from their 500-member land trust and gave two other alternatives to the rule, two other tax rules. One is called the tax benefit rule, and the other is called the remote future event rule, and Judge Holmes explains those in detail in footnote 8 on JA 1142. And says that those are rules that would accomplish Treasury's policy objectives without having the chilling effects on donations that the proceeds clause has. That was one of the.
How would the tax benefit rule actually operate?
The tax benefit rule would operate by reducing the taxpayer's basis in land, and then if there were an eventual condemnation and Fifth Amendment award of takings proceeds thereafter, there would be additional gain and those proceeds would be taxable to assure that the taxpayer didn't get a windfall based on a partial or complete taking.
But how would that perpetuate the conservation easement?
Well, first of all, the only time that this can ever come up is in a situation where, by definition, the conservation purpose of the easement has been destroyed by governmental action.
Yes, but the way the regulation is written, it has to ensure that the donee, the conservation entity, uses money for a conservation purpose. So I'm not really clear how affecting the donor's tax benefit would impact the perpetuity requirement that the statute has.
I think that the answer is that there is an assumption that somehow the current provisions in this deed are unacceptable, and there's a host of different ways this could be calculated.
I'm asking you a specific question, not about this deed, but about how the tax benefit rule really is a valid alternative here. And you, the way you described the tax benefit rule, it was that it was going to provide constraints on the donor later on, but I thought that the perpetuity requirement is to make sure that the conservation easement is a permanent benefit for conservation.
It is that, Your Honor, that the conservation purpose be protected in perpetuity, and the other concern that's been articulated is a windfall to the taxpayer, and the tax benefit rule would prevent any issues around that.
Yeah, but are you conceding then my point that the tax benefit rule does not ensure that an amount is dedicated in perpetuity for conservation?
Not in and of itself alone, but there are other provisions in this deed that do, that ensure that the first...
Well, but we were talking about the comments that were made, and your criticism is that the comments are not responded to by the Treasury. And there was the general comment of a tax benefit rule, but if the tax benefit rule has no bearing on the purpose of the perpetuity requirement of the statute, it's not clear why Treasury would have to respond to that comment.
So first of all, we don't know what the purpose of that was because Treasury didn't tell us. And second, there's another comment from the Landmarks Preservation Council of Illinois on JA 778 and 779. And what they said was that these issues should be negotiated, defined, and incorporated by the donor and donee into the conservation right document on a property-by-property basis. That's what happened here. The land trust drafted this deed and thought that it best protected, because what often happens in a taking is not that the entire property is destroyed, that there's a strip, you know, that they need to install a sewer line or build a road on a strip of the property. And the way that the land trust here, who has a fiduciary responsibility to protect the interests of conservation, was that it thought it was better protected by having the first slice of that money go to them. That was their way of protecting the conservation purpose in perpetuity. And our deed better protects that possibility than the formulas that the comments have talked about or the formulas that the government now proposes. And both of those comments gave an alternative. They said, let the land trust negotiate and protect its own interest, rely on the tax benefit rule, and the New York Landmarks Commission said, don't have the rule at all. Those are alternatives, and Treasury very well could have rejected those alternatives. Absolutely. They had the option to come back and say, we don't like any of the proposed alternatives for the following reasons, but Treasury didn't do any of those things. It's indisputable here, if you look at the six columns in the Federal Register of what Treasury did, that they didn't provide any response whatsoever. And why is that so important? It's not just that, you know, it's a mindless exercise they can go through. It's because there are now hundreds or thousands of people who had a regulation that the Fifth Circuit and PPBM said was ambiguous, who, you know, for whatever reason, have found themselves in a situation where the IRS says now that their deed didn't comply. And one of the reasons it's so...
If I could ask a question,
sure.
Just on timing. When was this deed signed?
One second, Your Honor.
Roughly, in terms of age.
I think this deed dates to 2008. Thank you.
Okay, so the deed was well after the regulation was enacted in 86.
Yes,
right?
That's correct.
So you had perfect notice of what the regulation said. You just didn't comply with it.
We had perfect notice of a regulation that the courts have held was ambiguous. That's what PPBM says. And had we had the explanation that Treasury is supposed to provide, had the regulated community here...
Couldn't you have asked, I'm asking this as an honest, genuine question, couldn't you have asked for a ruling from the IRS that your language would be compliant with the regulation?
And that's what one taxpayer did in 2008, and Treasury raised no issue with that language in the regulation. That's one of our other issues here. We didn't. That was a procedural opportunity that was available. But Treasury had never articulated in the 22 years since this had been promulgated that particular interpretation of the regulation, that it required a specific mathematical formula. The language in the statute is protected in perpetuity, and there's probably a lot of room to interpret those words, but it's very hard to read into those words without a valid regulation, a specific mathematical formula. That's not typically what we would put in the words protected in perpetuity. And
did Congress ever express any distaste for this regulation that was enacted and that was promulgated and adopted in 1986?
Before the regulation was promulgated, as we explain on reply brief pages 8 and 9, the JCT asked, should there be specific provisions in the statute to cover what happens if the conservation purposes are not provided for? And Congress at that time did not make any changes to add to the statute. There has been no congressional response since then. We would note that there is a proposed bill pending before Congress now that would give some taxpayers the opportunity to cure these perpetuity requirements. It's hard to read much into proposed legislation, but it does seem that some people recognize the inherent unfairness of what's going on here. So Some of the things that the tax court said about why this, what the Treasury did in this reg project and why it was acceptable under the APA are very difficult to square with the governing case law. You know, the court put some emphasis on the phrase at the beginning, after all comments considered, and that's squarely in opposition to Encino Motor Cars and the Supreme Court, which said that was an insufficient way to ensure that Treasury had vetted all of the policy issues, as this court's decision in Sims requires. And as you look at that tax court majority, that kind of has to make sense, because otherwise any agency could take the phrase, we considered all the comments, and put it in front of every regulation project, and there'd never need to be another APA case again, because if that talismanic language were to suffice, that would eliminate review under the APA. The tax court suggested that there was some problem that some of these comments came towards the end of comment letters. That was also a strange comment to read, because it's certainly the case that Treasury proposed this regulation project in a specific order, and if you read through the comments, people gave their comments in a specific order that followed Treasury's. So if comments on the proceeds regulation came at the end of those comments, it's only because the comments were following the way that Treasury had proposed the regulations. And then there's the thought that maybe these comments weren't significant. And the court has never, here in this circuit, provided a precise definition of what a significant comment is. But we would submit that in a situation we now find ourselves where the IRS is disallowing what the tax court said was hundreds, if not thousands, of deductions, the comments about this very specific provision that they're using to do so are significant. And I see I'm running out of time here. If I could reserve the rest for rebuttal, please.
May it please the court. May it please the court, Nathaniel Pollack representing the commissioner. The Oak Brook's conservation easement is non-deductible for three alternative and independent reasons. The first is that the deed's extinguishment provision violates the plain terms of the statute. The second is that it violates the valid regulatory requirement that proceeds be determined on a proportionate rather than on a fixed value basis. And the third, though we see no reason that the court should reach this issue, is that it violates the valid regulatory requirement that proceeds attributable to improvements not be subtracted out of the amount of extinguishment proceeds to be proportionately distributed between the donor and donee. Oak Brook's extinguishment provision caps the extinguishment proceeds available to the donee at the date of grant value of the easement. And then it reduces that amount by the value of post-grant improvements. So in real terms, if the date of grant value of the easement is $1 million and the value determined to for post-grant improvements such that are allowed by the deed, such as barns, observation pavilions, a replica water wheel, wells, etc., if those are valued at $600,000, then the amount of extinguishment proceeds available to the donee would be $400,000. Such a capped and then reduced measure of extinguishment proceeds simply violates both the statute and the applicable regulation. The statute requires two things relevant here. It requires that the donee receive a real property interest, and it requires that the purpose of that interest, that is the purpose of the conservation easement, be protected in perpetuity. As Judge Toro and three other tax court judges concluded, Oak Brook's deed violates those requirements by denying the donee the right to receive the value of its property interest in the event of extinguishment. The regulation reflects Treasury's determination that although the possibility of extinguishment or the prospect of extinguishment could be understood to make it impossible to comply with the protected in perpetuity requirement, the easement will not, in quoting the regulation, will nonetheless be treated as protected in perpetuity if protections for the donee and ultimately for the public are put in place. Thus, the deed must grant donees at least a proportionate amount of any extinguishment proceeds, and Oak Brook's deed undisputedly violates that requirement. I want to address...
Did you, you I, hear you endorsing Judge Toro's position. Did you advocate that position in the tax court, or did Judge Toro come up with that sua sponte?
Judge Toro came up with that position. However, in the tax court, the government did argue that the protected in perpetuity requirements were not met. It focused
on the statute?
Well, it focused on the regulation, which at the time wasn't being, the validity of which at the time wasn't being challenged. Then later, the tax court judge presiding raised the question of validity, and that was then briefed after that point. But we would also point the court to, I think clear authority that allows the appellee to defend the judgment below on an alternative ground. For instance, the Supreme Court said a prevailing party, of course, may of course assert in a reviewing court any ground in support of his judgment, whether or not that ground was relied upon or even considered by the trial court. That's Dandridge versus Williams. This court has said similarly, should the appellee not elect to file a cross appeal, the appellee may urge in support of the decree any matter appearing on the record, although the argument may involve an attack on the reasoning of the lower court or an insistence upon a matter overlooked by it. That's this court, I believe, quoting American Railway Express Company, which is a Supreme Court case. So we don't think that the argument is waived, nor did we need to cross appeal, since we're not asking for anything other than affirmance of the judgment below. But on the merits of the statutory language, Oakbrook's principal contention is that somehow the protected in perpetuity requirement only applies to donors. We submit that that's just inconsistent with the plain language of the statute. The plain language of the statute applies the protected in perpetuity requirement to the donation, that is, to the easement. The easement has to be protected in perpetuity, and there's nothing in the language of the statute that limits that protection to donors. Oakbrook also cites, in support of its statutory argument, a Senate report, urging that this legislative history supports its argument about what the statute means. But I would submit that if you look at the Senate report, after describing the protected in perpetuity's application to donors, it goes on to describe the protected in perpetuity requirements application to donees, saying specifically that the requirement is intended to limit deductible contributions to those transfers which require that the donee or the donee's successor in interest hold the conservation easement exclusively for conservation purposes. In other words, that requirement prevents the donee from transferring the conservation easement to an entity that's not going to be able or willing to protect the conservation easement purposes. And then not only that, the same report also states that the donee organizations may enforce the perpetual restrictions against, quote, against all other parties in interest. Council mentioned the question raised by a congressional committee that at one point, asked, should the statute directly address this question of extinguishment? We submit
when that was that committee? When did that committee raise that question?
I believe that was prior to enactment of the statute, and I think it was the Senate Finance Committee, although I'm not positive of that.
Prior to the enactment of the statute?
Yeah, and prior to the hearing. So then that question was to some degree addressed by witnesses who came before that committee in a hearing regarding the bill. And at least one of those witnesses responded to that question by saying, well, the donee should be compensated in the event of an extinguishment, but that the issue would be better dealt with by a regulation. That response is quoted on page 11 of the article attached to the government's brief.
But you're saying that comment from a congressional committee was before the enactment of the statute in...
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It seems to us that the plain language of the statute decides the case. The principal aspect of the regulation that's at issue, if this court were to get to the question of the regulation and its validity, is the determination to use a proportionate measure of require that in order to determine extinguishment proceeds. And that aspect of the regulation really was not criticized directly by any of the comments. None of the comments say there's really a big problem with using a proportionate measure of extinguishment proceeds, and instead we should use a fixed value measure of extinguishment proceeds.
So with a proportionate method, if the value of the property goes up between the time of the deed and the time of the eminent domain proceeding, then the donee would receive more money under a proportionate basis than under a fixed basis if the value of property goes up. But if the value of the property goes down, the donee would receive less money. Is that right?
That is true, yes, Your Honor. So it would be on a percentage basis. So if the easement is worth 40% of the overall value of the land, then the donee would be guaranteed. And the regulation makes clear that it's a minimum. So it could be, you know, there could be a more generous provision to the donee that would certainly be consistent with the regulation. But the donee would be guaranteed at least 40% of the extinguishment proceeds in that
case. And am I right that an important part of this regulation is G6 little I, which requires that all of the donee's proceeds, must be used by the donee in a manner consistent with the conservation purposes?
Precisely, Your Honor. That's the whole. I think Oak Brook talks a lot about, you know, the Treasury not explaining itself, but I would say, Your Honor, that this regulation maybe somewhat uniquely answers the why question in the text of the regulation itself. If you look at subsection little I of that regulation, I think what you see is Treasury sort of asking and answering a question. The question is, what do we do about the fact that there's a possibility that conservation easements would be extinguished under state law? And the answer to that question is, well, there is this prospect of extinguishment, but we're going to conclude that notwithstanding the possibility of extinguishment, nonetheless, it's going to be possible for the protected in perpetuity requirements to be met. But it's not that they can just be met automatically without any protections. In order for that to be true, it's got to be the case that donees' interests are protected. And in order to protect the donees' interests, the Treasury does a number of things. It says that the extinguishment has to be judicially determined. It says that there has to be this minimum measure of extinguishment proceeds, and it says that all the proceeds have to go to conservation purposes. Those are the conditions under which the protected in perpetuity requirements can be met, notwithstanding the prospect of extinguishment.
So when you started off your argument, you said that you were going to rely less heavily on the improvement portion of the regulation. Why are you?
Well, we certainly think that the improvement portion of the regulation is valid, and to the question of somehow indeterminacy or that the regulation is somehow unclear, we now have the Fifth Circuit, the 11th Circuit, and the Tax Court have all concluded that this regulation on its face does not allow for subtracting out improvements. And so we think that the improvements requirement is valid and we defend it. The only the point here is this deed is somewhat unique in that its principal problem is this fixed value measure of extinguishment proceeds, and then it uses the improvement subtraction language to reduce that fixed value. That's different than many. That aspect of the or that kind of a of a provision we submit is relatively unprecedented, or there aren't too many cases that deal with that kind of provision. What there are more cases dealing with is a provision where, by and large, the proceeds are determined under the deed under a proportionate value measure, but the improvements are subtracted out before that proportionate value is assessed. And that's that kind of language more directly puts this improvements question at issue. Here, there's simply sort of the prior problems. Before you get to the improvements issue, there's already the issue of the deed's non-compliance with the statutory language and the deed's non-compliance with the proportionate measure. And so it's sort of just as a, these problems are logically prior to getting to the improvements issue.
I have a question just relative to the way this proceeds. When a donor landowner and a donee conservation agency agree to the gift coming to the conservation agency, at that point, am I correct that the first tax consequences is that the donor would seek tax consideration for the donation of the land to the conservation agency? There would be a write-off there.
That's right, Your Honor.
Is that right? So at that time, does the IRS or anybody make any review of the deed, or do they just accept whatever language? Do they even look at the document that underlies the donation?
Your Honor, as Judge Moore mentioned, there is available to the parties, they could seek a private letter ruling.
I understand that, but I meant as a matter of course, the IRS is not likely to say, well, we're not giving you this write-off because your deed language doesn't guarantee this, that, or the other thing.
It's correct, Your Honor, that the donation, the deduction would go forward as a normal tax deduction. As a matter of course. And then if it's reviewed, as quite frequently they are, but if the IRS, then audits the taxpayer, at that point it would look at the deed language.
The first real review then comes when the condition is such that the easement value or easement purpose is negated. That would be the first time this would come under the microscope of review.
That's true, Your Honor.
I thought that the IRS sees the taxpayer taking a $9 million deduction here in the year of the deduction.
Right.
And then the IRS challenges the taxpayer in the year of the deduction, not when something later happens.
No, yes, Your Honor, that's right. The question is, this is a deficiency proceeding, and I think that's important to keep in mind. The issue is the IRS assesses a deficiency based on that tax return, the tax return that takes the $9 million.
Here, when the taxpayer donor is saying,
right,
we want a deduction because we've given this.
Within the limitations period for reviewing that, tax year's reporting, yes, that the IRS at that point looks at it and concludes that the language of the deed violates.
And so what tax year are we looking at? Your opponent said this deed was in 2008.
Yes, I believe that is correct.
The deduction was
taken in 2008. So this is a deficiency proceeding with respect to the 2008 year's tax return for Oak Brook. Thank you for the questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the procedural issue, Judge Moore, we agree that this is a deficiency proceeding challenging the initial deduction. There's not an iota of evidence anywhere in this record about this deduction ever, or this easement ever being extinguished, or in fact, any other easement ever being extinguished. There's nothing about that in the record. And one of the
that
things
that wouldn't happen because the challenge is in the tax year when the easement is given and the choice is made to take this big deduction.
It would
happen. But the eminent domain is something that you're worried about in the future, a long time hence.
What we were saying is these statutory provisions have been in place for decades, and there's no evidence of an eminent domain proceeding taking an easement. of any variety, and not a tax proceeding. Someone could cite a state law proceeding that would say, in this action, you know, someone's easement has been taken. We're just saying there's no evidence of this actually happening, which is one of the reasons that the commenters talked about that this was something that would fit within, from during the comments, the remote future contingency rule. As to the statute, I'd like to make one point. The government is saying two conflicting things here. On the one hand, they're saying that the statute itself, absent the regulation, requires a certain mathematical formula of proceeds to go to the donee, or else the statute's not satisfied. But the regulation itself provides for exceptions that say that unless the state law provides that the donor is entitled to the full proceeds from the conversion without regards to the terms of the prior perpetual conservation restrictions, there are actually situations in the regulation in which the donee land trust gets zero. So it can't be that the statute requires that and that the regulation is consistent with the statute. The final thing that we would say is there's lots of discussion today about what this regulation was trying to accomplish. But none of that is in the regulation itself, nor does it explain why this specific formula was the one that they wanted. And we've noted in our brief that there are situations where our deed language better protects the conservation purposes because all proceeds come straight off the top, up to the $9.545 million number for this taxpayer. And in any situation in which there is less than a $9.545 million taking award, the donee organization gets all of it first. And that is the way that the land trust organization thought itself best protected in this situation. And we would submit that that's exactly what some of the commenters suggested would happen, and that there was nothing from Treasury that explained why they didn't agree with that choice. And that's why the regulation needs to be reversed. One final point on the statute. It was not briefed by us below. It was rejected by the tax court majority and by Judge Holmes. And we would submit that it would be appropriate, to the extent there's a question about that and whether it's preserved, that the tax court ought to have the opportunity to address that in the first instance, and that the reg should be the focus of this proceeding. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both for your argument. The case will be submitted, and the clerk may call the next case.